by 50%. Exercise and weight loss. Conventionally, diet and exercise have been prescribed as treatments for obesity as if they are equally important. But diet and exercise are not 50-50 partners like macaroni and cheese. Diet is Batman, and exercise is Robin. Diet does 95% of the work and deserves all the attention, so logically, it would be sensible to focus on diet. Exercise is still healthy and important, just not equally important. It has many benefits, but weight loss is not among them. Exercise is like brushing your teeth. It is good for you and should be done every day, just don't expect to lose weight. Consider this baseball analogy. Bunting is an important technique, but accounts for only perhaps 5% of the game. The other 95% revolves around hitting, pitching, and fielding. So, it would be ridiculous to spend 50% of our time practicing the bunt. Or, what if we were facing a test that is 95% math and 5% spelling? Would we spend 50% of our time studying spelling? The fact that exercise always produces less weight loss than expected has been well documented in medical research. Studies lasting more than 25 weeks found that the actual weight loss was only 30% of what was expected. In one recent controlled study, participants increased exercise to 5 times per week, burning 600 calories per session. Over 10 months, those who exercised lost an extra 10 pounds, 4.5 kilograms. However, the expected weight loss had been 35 pounds, 16 kilograms. Many other longer-term randomized studies have shown that exercise has minimal or no effect on weight loss. A randomized 2007 study of participants who did aerobics for 6 days per week over 1 year found that women reduced their weight, on average, by 3 pounds, approximately 1.4 kilograms. Men by 4, 1.8 kilograms. A Danish research team trained a previously sedentary group to run a marathon. Men averaged a loss of 5 pounds, about 2.3 kilograms of body fat. The average weight loss for women was zero. When it comes to weight loss, exercise is just not that effective. In these cases, it was also noted that body fat percentage was not much changed. The Woman's Health Study, the most ambitious, expensive, and comprehensive diet study ever done, also looked at exercise. The 39,876 women were divided into 3 groups representing high, more than 1 hour per day, medium, and low levels of weekly exercise. Over the next 10 years, the intense exercise group lost no extra weight. Furthermore, the study noted, no change in body composition was observed, meaning that muscle was not replacing fat. Compensation, the hidden culprit. Why does actual weight loss fall so far below projected? The culprit is a phenomenon known as compensation, and there are 2 major mechanisms. First, caloric intake increases in response to exercise. We just eat more following a vigorous workout. They don't call it working up an appetite for nothing. A prospective cohort study of 538 students from the Harvard School of Public Health found that, although physical activity is thought of as an energy deficit activity, our estimates do not support this hypothesis. For every extra hour of exercise, the kids ate an extra 292 calories. Caloric intake and expenditure are intimately related. Increasing one will cause an increase in the other. This is the biological principle of homeostasis. The body tries to maintain a stable state. Reducing calories in reduces calories out. Increasing calories out increases calories in. The second mechanism of compensation relates to a reduction in non-exercise activity. If you exert yourself all day, you are less likely to exercise in your free time. The Hadza, who were walking all day, reduced their physical activity when they could. In contrast, those North Americans who were sitting all day probably increased their activity when given the chance. This principle also holds true in children. Students aged 7 and 8 years who received physical education in schools were compared to those who did not. The physical education group received an average of 9.2 hours per week of exercise through school, while the other group got none. Total physical activity, measured with accelerometers, showed there is no difference in total activity over the week between the two groups. Why? The phys ed group compensated by doing less at home. The non-phys ed group compensated by doing more when they got home. In the end, it was a wash. In addition, the benefit of exercise has a natural upper limit. You cannot make up for dietary indiscretions by increasing exercise. You can't outrun a poor diet. Furthermore, more exercise is not always better. Exercise represents a stress on the body. Small amounts are beneficial, but excessive amounts are detrimental. Exercise is simply not all that effective in the treatment of obesity, and the implications are enormous. Vast sums of money are spent to promote physical education in school. The Let's Move initiative, improved access to sports facilities, and improved playgrounds for children, all based on the flawed notion that exercise is instrumental in the fight against obesity. If we want to reduce obesity, we need to focus on what makes us obese. If we spend all our money, research, time, and mental energy focused on exercise, we will have no resources left with which to actually fight obesity. We are writing a final examination called Obesity 101. Diet accounts for 95% of the grade, and exercise for only 5%. Yet we spend 50% of our time and energy studying exercise. It is no wonder that our current grade is F for fat. Postscript. Dr. Peter Attia, finally acknowledging that he was a little, not thin, launched a detailed self-investigation about the cause of obesity. Ignoring conventional nutritional advice and completely overhauling his diet, he was able to lose some of the excess fat that had always plagued him. The experience so moved him that he has selflessly dedicated his career to the minefield that is obesity research. Chapter 5. The Overfeeding Paradox. Sam Feltham, a qualified master personal trainer, has worked in the UK health and fitness industry for more than a decade. Not accepting the caloric reduction theory, he set out to prove it false, following the grand scientific tradition of self-experimentation. In a modern twist to the classical overeating experiments, Feltham decided that he would eat 5,794 calories per day and document his weight gain. But the diet he chose was not a random 5,794 calories. He followed a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet of natural foods for 21 days. Feltham believed, based on clinical experience, that refined carbohydrates, not total calories, caused weight gain. The macronutrient breakdown of his diet was 10% carbohydrate, 53% fat, and 37% protein. Standard calorie calculations predicted a weight gain of about 16 pounds, 7.3 kilograms. actual weight gain, however, was only about 2.8 pounds, 1.3 kilograms. Even more interesting, he dropped more than 1 inch, 2.5 centimeters, from his waist measurement. He gained weight, but it was lean mass. Perhaps Felton was simply one of those genetic lottery people who are able to eat anything and not gain weight. So, in the next experiment, Felton abandoned the low-carb, high-fat diet. Instead, for 21 days, he ate 5,793 calories per day of a standard American diet with lots of highly processed fake foods. The macronutrient breakdown of his new diet was 64% carbs, 22% fat, and 14% protein, remarkably similar to the U.S. dietary guidelines. This time, the weight gain almost exactly mirrors that predicted by the calorie formula, 15.6 pounds, 7.1 kilograms. His waist size positively ballooned by 3.6 inches, 9.14 centimeters. After only 3 weeks, Felton was developing love handles. In the same person, and with an almost identical caloric intake, the two different diets produced strikingly different results. Clearly, something more than calories is at work here, since diet composition apparently plays a large role. The overfeeding paradox is that excess calories alone are not sufficient for weight gain, in contradiction to the caloric reduction theory. Overfeeding experiments, unexpected results. The hypothesis that eating too much causes obesity is easily testable. You simply take a group of volunteers, deliberately overfeed them, and watch what happens. If the hypothesis is true, the result should be obesity. Luckily for us, such experiments have already been done. Dr. Ethan Sims performed the most famous of these studies in the late 1960s. He tried to force mice to gain weight. Despite ample food, the mice ate only enough to be full. After that, no inducement could get them to eat. They would not become obese. Force-feeding the mice caused an increase in their metabolism, so once again, no weight was gained. Sims then asked a devastatingly brilliant question. Could he make humans deliberately gain weight? This question, so deceptively simple, had never before been experimentally answered. After all, we already thought we knew the answer. Of course overfeeding would lead to obesity. But does it really? Sims recruited lean college students at the nearby University of Vermont and encouraged them to eat whatever they wanted to gain weight. But despite what both he and the students had expected, the students could not become obese. To his utter amazement, it wasn't easy to make people gain weight after all. While this news may sound strange, think about the last time you ate at the all-you-can-eat buffet. You were stuffed to the gills. Now can you imagine downing another two pork chops? Yeah, not so easy. Furthermore, have you ever tried to feed a baby who is absolutely refusing to eat? They scream bloody murder. It is just about impossible to make them overeat. Convincing people to overeat is not the simple task it first seems. Dr. Sims changed course. Perhaps the difficulty here was that the students were increasing their exercise and therefore burning off the weight, which might explain their failure to gain weight. So, the next step was to overfeed, but limit physical activity so that it remained constant. For this experiment, he recruited convicts at the Vermont State Prison. Attendants were present at every meal to verify that the calories, 4,000 per day, were eaten. Physical activity was strictly controlled. A funny thing happened. The prisoners' weight initially rose, but then stabilized. Though at first they'd been happy to increase their caloric intake, as their weight started to increase, they found it more and more difficult to overeat, and some dropped out of the study. But some prisoners were persuaded to eat upwards of 10,000 calories per day. Over the next 4 to 6 months, the remaining prisoners did eventually gain 20% to 25% of their original body weight, actually much less than caloric theory predicted. Weight gain varied greatly person to person. Something was contributing to the vast differences in weight gained, but it was not caloric intake or exercise. The key was metabolism. Total energy expenditure in the subjects increased by 50%. Starting from an average of 1,800 calories per day, total energy expenditure increased to 2,700 calories per day. Their bodies tried to burn off the excess calories in order to return to their original weight. Total energy expenditure, comprising mostly basal metabolic rate, is not constant, but varies considerably in response to caloric intake. After the experiment ended, body weight quickly and effortlessly returned to normal. Most of the participants did not retain any of the weight they gained. Overeating did not, in fact, lead to lasting weight gain. In the same way, undereating does not lead to lasting weight loss. In another study, Dr. Sims compared two groups of patients. He overfed a group of thin patients until they became obese. The second group was made up of very obese patients who dieted until they were only obese, but the same weight as the first group. This resulted in two groups of patients who were equally heavy, but one group had originally been thin and one group originally very obese. What was the difference in total energy expenditure between the two groups? Those originally very obese subjects were burning only half as many calories as the originally thin subjects. The bodies of the originally very obese subjects were trying to return to their original higher weights by reducing metabolism. In contrast, the bodies of the originally thin subjects were trying to return to their original lower weights by increasing metabolism. Let's return to our power plant analogy. Suppose that we receive 2,000 tons of coal daily and burn 2,000 tons. Now, all of a sudden, we start receiving 4,000 tons daily. What should we do? Say we continue to burn 2,000 tons daily. The coal will pile up until all available room is used. Our boss yells, "Why are you storing your dirty coal in my office? Your ass is fired!" Instead, though, we do the smart thing. Increase coal burning to 4,000 tons daily. More power is generated and no coal piles up. The boss says, "You're doing a great job. We just broke the record for power generation. Raises all around." Our body also responds in a similarly smart manner. Increased caloric intake is met with increased caloric expenditure. With the increase in total energy expenditure, we have more energy, more body heat, and we feel great. After the period of forced overeating, the increased metabolism quickly sheds the excess pounds of fat. The increase in non-exercise activity thermogenesis may account for up to 70% of the increased energy expenditure. The results described here are by no means isolated findings. Virtually all overeating studies have produced the same result. In a 1992 study, subjects were overfed calories by 50% over 6 weeks. Body weight and fat mass did transiently increase. Average total energy expenditure increased by more than 10% in an effort to burn off the excess calories. After the forced overfeeding period, body weight returned to normal and total energy expenditure decreased back to its baseline. The paper concluded that there was evidence that a physiological sensor was sensitive to the fact that body weight had been perturbed and was attempting to reset it. More recently, Dr. Frederick Nystrom experimentally overfed subjects double their usual daily calories on a fast food diet. On average, weight and body mass index increased 9%, and body fat increased 18%. By itself, no surprise. But what happened to total energy expenditure? Calories expended per day increased by 12%. Even when ingesting some of the most fattening foods in the world, the body still responds to the increased caloric load by trying to burn it off. The theory of obesity that's been dominant for the last half century, that excess calories inevitably lead to obesity, the theory that's assumed to be unassailably true, was simply not true. None of it was true. And if excess calories don't cause weight gain, then reducing calories won't cause weight loss. The body set weight. You can temporarily force your body weight higher than your body wants it to be by consuming excess calories. Over time, the resulting higher metabolism will reduce your weight back to normal. Similarly, you can temporarily force your body weight lower than your body wants it to be by reducing calories. Over time, the resulting lowered metabolism will raise your weight back to normal. Since losing weight reduces total energy expenditure, many obese people assume that they have a slow metabolism, but the opposite has proved to be true. Lean subjects had a mean total energy expenditure of 2,404 calories, while the obese had a mean total energy expenditure of 3,244 calories, despite spending less time exercising. The obese body was not trying to gain weight. It was trying to lose it by burning off the excess energy. So then, why are the obese obese? The fundamental biological principle at work here is homeostasis. There appears to be a set point for body weight and fatness, as first proposed in 1984 by Kesey and Corbett. Homeostatic mechanisms defend this body set weight against changes, both up and down. If weight drops below body set weight, compensatory mechanisms activate to raise it. If weight goes above body set weight, compensatory mechanisms activate to lower it. The problem in obesity is that the set point is too high. Let's take an example. Suppose our body set weight is 200 pounds, approximately 90 kilograms. By restricting calories, we will briefly lose weight, say down to 180 pounds, approximately 81 kilograms. If the body set weight stays at 200 pounds, the body will try to regain the lost weight by stimulating appetite. Ghrelin is increased, and the satiety hormones, amylin, peptide YY, and cholecystokinin, are suppressed. At the same time, the body will decrease its total energy expenditure. Metabolism begins shutting down. Body temperatures drop, heart rate drops, blood pressure drops, and heart volume decreases, all in a desperate effort to conserve energy. We feel hungry, cold, and tired, a scenario familiar to dieters. Unfortunately, the result is the regain of weight back to the original body set weight of 200 pounds. This outcome, too, is familiar to dieters. Eating more is not the cause of weight gain, but instead the consequence. Eating more does not make us fat. Getting fat makes us eat more. Overeating was not a personal choice. It is a hormonally driven behavior, a natural consequence of increased hunger hormones. The question, then, is what makes us fat in the first place? In other words, why is the body set weight so high? The body set weight also works in the reverse. If we overeat, we will briefly gain weight, say to 220 pounds, approximately 100 kilograms. If the body set weight stays at 200 pounds, then the body activates mechanisms to lose weight. Appetite decreases, metabolism increases, trying to burn off the excess calories. The result is weight loss. Our body is not a simple scale balancing calories in and calories out. Rather, our body is a thermostat. The set point for weight, the body set weight, is vigorously defended against both increase and decrease. Dr. Rudolf Leibel elegantly proved this concept in 1995. Subjects were deliberately overfed or underfed to reach the desired weight gain or loss. First, the group was overfed in order to gain 10% of their body weight. Then their diet was adjusted to return them to their initial weight, and then a further 10% or 20% weight loss was achieved. Energy expenditure was measured under all of these conditions. As subjects' body weight increased by 10%, their daily energy expenditure increased by almost 500 calories. As expected, the body responded to the intake of excess calories by trying to burn them off. As weight returned to normal, the total energy expenditure also returned to baseline. As the group lost 10% and 20% of their weight, their bodies reduced their daily total energy expenditure by approximately 300 calories. Underfeeding did not result in the weight loss expected because the total energy expenditure decreased to counter it. Leibel's study was revolutionary because it forced a paradigm shift in our understanding of obesity. No wonder it is so hard to keep the weight off. Diets work well at the start, but as we lose weight, our metabolism slows. Compensatory mechanisms start almost immediately and persist almost indefinitely. We must then reduce our caloric intake further and further simply to maintain the weight loss. If we don't, our weight plateaus and then starts to creep back up, just as every dieter already knows. It's also hard to gain weight, but we don't usually concern ourselves with that problem unless we are sumo wrestlers. Virtually every dietary study of the last century has documented this finding. Now we know why. Consider our thermostat analogy. Normal room temperature is 70 degrees Fahrenheit, 21 degrees Celsius. If the house thermostat were set instead to 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees Celsius, we'd find it too cold. Using the first law of thermodynamics, we decide that the temperature of the house depends upon heat in versus heat out. As fundamental law of physics, it is inviolable. Since we need more heat in, we buy a portable heater and plug it in. But heat in is only the proximate cause of the high temperature. The temperature at first goes up in response to the heater, but then the thermostat, sensing the higher temperature, turns on the air conditioner. The air conditioner and the heater constantly fight against each other until the heater finally breaks. The temperature returns to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. The mistake here is to focus on the proximate and not the ultimate cause. The ultimate cause of the cold was the low setting of the thermostat. Our failure was that we did not recognize that the house contained a homeostatic mechanism, the thermostat, to return the temperature to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. The smarter solution would have been for us to identify the thermostat's control and simply set it to a more comfortable 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and so avoid the fight between the heater and the air conditioner. The reason diets are so hard and often unsuccessful is that we are constantly fighting our own body. As we lose weight, our body tries to bring it back up. The smarter solution is to identify the body's homeostatic mechanism and adjust it downward. And there lies our challenge. Since obesity results from a high body set weight, the treatment for obesity is to lower it. But how do we lower our thermostat? The search for answers would lead to the discovery of leptin. Leptin, the search for a hormonal regulator. Dr. Alfred Frohlich from the University of Vienna first began to unravel the neurohormonal basis of obesity in 1890. He described a young boy with the sudden onset of obesity who was eventually diagnosed with a lesion in the hypothalamus area of the brain. It would be later confirmed that hypothalamic damage resulted in intractable weight gain in humans. This established the hypothalamic region as a key regulatory of energy balance and was also a vital clue that obesity is a hormonal imbalance. Neurons in these hypothalamic areas were somehow responsible for setting an ideal weight, the body set weight. Brain tumors, traumatic injuries, and radiation in or to this critical area cause massive obesity that is often resistant to treatment, even with a 500-calorie-per-day diet. The hypothalamus integrates incoming signals regarding energy intake and expenditure. However, the control mechanism was still unknown. Romain Hervey proposed in 1959 that the fat cells produced a circulating satiety factor. As fat stores increased, the level of this factor would also increase. This factor circulated through the blood to the hypothalamus, causing the brain to send out signals to reduce appetite or increase metabolism, thereby reducing fat stores back to normal. In this way, the body protected itself from being overweight. The race to find the satiety factor was on. Discovered in 1994, this factor was leptin, a protein produced by the fat cells. The name leptin was derived from lepto, the Greek word for thin. The mechanism was very similar to that proposed decades earlier by Hervey. Higher levels of fat tissue produce higher levels of leptin. Traveling to the brain, it turns down hunger to prevent further fat storage. Rare human cases of leptin deficiency were soon found. Treatment with exogenous leptin, that is, leptin manufactured outside the body, produced dramatic reversals of the associated massive obesity. The discovery of leptin provoked tremendous excitement within the pharmaceutical and scientific communities. There was a sense that the obesity gene had, at long last, been found. However, while it played a crucial role in these rare cases of massive obesity, it was still to be determined whether it played any role in common human obesity. Exogenous leptin was administered to patients in escalating doses, and we watched with breathless anticipation as the patients did not lose any weight. Study after study confirmed this crushing disappointment. The vast majority of obese people are not deficient in leptin. Their leptin levels are high, not low. But these high levels did not produce the desired effect of lowering body fatness. Obesity is a state of leptin resistance. Leptin is one of the primary hormones involved in weight regulation in the normal state. However, in obesity, it is a secondary hormone because it fails the causality test. Giving leptin doesn't make people thin. Human obesity is a disease of leptin resistance, not leptin deficiency. This leaves us with much the same question that we began with. What causes leptin resistance? What causes obesity? Part 3. A New Model of Obesity. Chapter 6. A New Hope. The caloric reduction theory of obesity was as useful as a half-built bridge. Studies repeatedly proved it did not lead to permanent weight loss. Either the eat less, move more strategy was ineffective, or patients were not following it. Healthcare professionals could not abandon the calorie model, so what was left to do? Blame the patient, of course. Doctors and dietitians berated, ridiculed, belittled, and reprimanded. They were drawn irresistibly to caloric reduction because it transformed obesity from their failure to understand it into our lack of willpower and/or laziness. But the truth cannot be suppressed indefinitely. The caloric reduction model was just wrong. It didn't work. Excess calories did not cause obesity, so reduced calories could not cure it. Lack of exercise did not cause obesity, so increased exercise could not cure it. The false gods of the caloric religion had been exposed as charlatans. From those ashes, we can now begin to build a newer, more robust theory of obesity. And with greater understanding of weight gain, we have a new hope that we can develop more rational, successful treatments. What causes weight gain? Contending theories abound. Calories, sugar, refined carbohydrates, wheat, all carbohydrates, dietary fat, red meat, all meat, dairy products, snacking, food reward, food addiction, sleep deprivation, stress, low fiber intake, genetics, poverty, wealth, gut microbiome, childhood obesity. The various theories fight among themselves as if they are all mutually exclusive and there is only one true cause of obesity. For example, recent trials that compare a low-calorie to a low-carbohydrate diet assume that if one is correct, the other is not. Most obesity research is conducted in this manner. This approach is wrong, since these theories all contain some element of truth. Let's look at an analogy. What causes heart attacks? Consider this partial list of contributing factors: family history, age, sex, diabetes, hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, smoking, stress, lack of physical activity. These factors, some modifiable and some not, all contribute to heart attack risk. Smoking is a risk factor, but that doesn't mean that diabetes is not. All are correct since they all contribute to some degree. Nonetheless, all are also incorrect because they are not the sole cause of heart attacks. For example, cardiovascular disease trials would not compare smoking cessation to blood pressure reduction since both are important contributing factors. The other major problem with obesity research is that it fails to take into account that obesity is a time-dependent disease. It develops only over long periods, usually decades. A typical patient will be a little overweight as a child and slowly gain weight, averaging 1 to 2 pounds, 0.5 to 1 kilogram per year. While this amount sounds small, over 40 years, the weight gained can add up to 80 pounds, 35 kilograms. Given the time it takes for obesity to develop, short-term studies are of limited use. Let's take an analogy. Suppose we were to study the development of rust in a pipe. We know that rusting is a time-dependent process that occurs over months of exposure to moisture. There would be no point in looking at studies of only 1 or 2 days' duration, as we might very well conclude that water does not cause pipe rust since we did not observe any rust forming during that 48 hours. But this mistake is made in human obesity studies all the time. Obesity develops over decades, yet hundreds of published studies consider only what happens in less than a year. Thousands more studies last less than a week. Still, they all claim to shed light on human obesity. There is no clear, focused, unified theory of obesity. There is no framework for understanding weight gain and weight loss. This lack impedes progress in research, and so we come to our challenge, to build the hormonal obesity theory. Obesity is a hormonal dysregulation of fat mass. The body maintains a body set weight, much like a thermostat in the house. When the body set weight is set too high, obesity results. If our current weight is below our body set weight, our body, by stimulating hunger and or decreasing metabolism, will try to gain weight to reach that body set weight. Thus, excessive eating and slowed metabolism are the result rather than the cause of obesity. But what caused our body set weight to be so high in the first place? This is, in essence, the same question as, what causes obesity? To find the answer, we need to know how the body set weight is regulated. How do we raise or lower our fat thermostat? The hormonal theory of obesity. Obesity is not caused by an excess of calories, but instead by a body set weight that is too high because of a hormonal imbalance in the body. Hormones are chemical messengers that regulate many body systems and processes such as appetite, fat storage, and blood sugar levels. But which hormones are responsible for obesity? Leptin, a key regulator of body fat, did not turn out to be the main hormone involved in setting the body weight. Ghrelin, the hormone that regulates hunger, and hormones such as peptide YY and cholecystokinin that regulate satiety, feeling full or satisfied, all play a role in making you start and stop eating, but they do not appear to affect the body set weight. How do we know? A hormone suspected of causing weight gain must pass the causality test. If we inject this hormone into people, they must gain weight. These hunger and satiety hormones do not pass the causality test, but there are two hormones that do, insulin and cortisol. In Chapter 3, we saw the caloric reduction view of obesity relies on five assumptions that have been proved to be wrong. This hormonal theory of obesity avoids making these false assumptions. Consider the following. Assumption 1. Calories in and calories out are independent of each other. The hormonal theory explains why calories in and calories out are tightly synchronized with each other. Assumption 2. Basal metabolic rate is stable. The hormonal theory explains how hormonal signals adjust basal metabolic rate to either gain or lose weight. Assumption 3. We exert conscious control over calories in. The hormonal theory explains that hunger and satiety hormones play a key role in determining whether we eat. Assumption 4. Fat stores are essentially unregulated. The hormonal theory explains that fat stores, like all body systems, are tightly regulated and respond to changes in food intake and activity levels. Assumption 5. A calorie is a calorie. The hormonal theory explains why different calories cause different metabolic responses. Sometimes, calories are used to heat the body. At other times, they will be deposited as fat. The mechanics of digestion. Before discussing insulin, we must understand hormones in general. Hormones are molecules that deliver messages to a target cell. For example, thyroid hormone delivers a message to cells in the thyroid gland to increase its activity. Insulin delivers the message to most human cells to take glucose out of the blood to use for energy. To deliver this message, hormones must attach to the target cell by binding to receptors on the cell surface, much like a lock and key. Insulin acts on the insulin receptor to bring glucose into the cell. Insulin is the key and fits snugly into the lock, the receptor. The door opens and glucose enters. All hormones work in roughly the same fashion. When we eat, foods are broken down in the stomach and small intestine. Proteins are broken into amino acids, Fats are broken into fatty acids. Carbohydrates, which are chains of sugars, are broken into smaller sugars. Dietary fiber is not broken down. It moves through us without being absorbed. All cells in the body can use blood sugar, glucose. Certain foods, particularly refined carbohydrates, raise blood sugar more than other foods. The rise in blood sugar stimulates insulin release. Protein raises insulin levels as well, although its effect on blood sugars is minimal. Dietary fats, on the other hand, tend to raise both blood sugars and insulin levels minimally. Insulin is then broken down and rapidly cleared from the blood with a half-life of only 2 to 3 minutes. Insulin is a key regulator of energy metabolism, and it is one of the fundamental hormones that promote fat accumulation and storage. Insulin facilitates the uptake of glucose into cells for energy. Without sufficient insulin, glucose builds up in the bloodstream. Type 1 diabetes results from the autoimmune destruction of the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas, which results in extremely low levels of insulin. The discovery of insulin, for which Frederick Banting and J.J.R. McLeod were awarded the 1923 Nobel Prize in Medicine, changed this formerly fatal disease into a chronic one. At mealtimes, ingested carbohydrate leads to more glucose being available than needed. Insulin helps move this flood of glucose out of the bloodstream into storage for later use. We store this glucose by turning it into glycogen in the liver, a process called glycogenesis. Genesis means the creation of, so this term means the creation of glycogen. Glucose molecules are strung together in long chains to form glycogen. Insulin is the main stimulus of glycogenesis. We can convert glucose to glycogen and back again quite easily. But the liver has only limited storage space for glycogen. Once full, excess carbohydrates will be turned into fat, a process called de novo lipogenesis. De novo means from new. Lipogenesis means making new fat. De novo lipogenesis means to make new fat. Several hours after a meal, blood sugars and insulin levels start to drop. Less glucose is available for use by the muscles, the brain, and other organs. The liver starts to break down glycogen into glucose to release it into general circulation for energy, the glycogen storage process in reverse. This happens most nights, assuming you don't eat at night. Glycogen is easily available, but in limited supply. During a short-term fast, fast meaning that you do not eat, your body has enough glycogen available to function. During a prolonged fast, your body can make new glucose from its fat stores, a process called gluconeogenesis, the making of new sugar. Fat is burned to release energy, which is then sent out to the body, the fat storage process in reverse. Insulin is a storage hormone. Ample intake of food leads to insulin release. Insulin then turns on storage of sugar and fat. When there is no intake of food, insulin levels fall and burning of sugar and fat is turned on. This process happens every day. Normally, this well-designed, balanced system keeps itself in check. We eat, insulin goes up, and we store energy as glycogen and fat. We fast, insulin goes down, and we use our stored energy. As long as our feeding and fasting periods are balanced, this system also remains balanced. If we eat breakfast at 7 a.m. and finish eating dinner at 7 p.m., the 12 hours of feeding balances the 12 hours of fasting. Glycogen is like your wallet. Money goes in and out constantly. The wallet is easily accessible, but can hold only a limited amount of money. Fat, however, is like the money in your bank account. It is harder to access that money, but there is an unlimited storage space for energy there in your account. Like the wallet, glycogen is quickly able to provide glucose to the body. However, the supply of glycogen is limited. Like the bank account, fat stores contain an unlimited amount of energy, but they are harder to access. This situation, of course, partially explains the difficulty in losing accumulated fat. Before getting money from the bank, you spend what's in your wallet first. But you don't like having an empty wallet. In the same manner, before getting energy from the fat bank, you spend the energy in the glycogen wallet. But you also don't like an empty glycogen wallet. So you keep the glycogen wallet filled, which prevents you from accessing the fat bank. In other words, before you can even begin to burn fat, you start feeling hungry and anxious because your glycogen is becoming depleted. If you continually refill your glycogen stores, you never need to use your fat stores for energy. What happens to the excess fat that is produced through de novo lipogenesis? This newly synthesized fat can be stored as visceral fat around organs, as subcutaneous fat underneath the skin, or in the liver. Under normal conditions, high insulin levels encourage sugar and fat storage. Low insulin levels encourage glycogen and fat burning. Sustained levels of excessive insulin will tend to increase fat storage. An imbalance between the feeding and fasting will lead to increased insulin, which causes increased fat, and voila, obesity. Could insulin be the hormonal regulator of body weight? Insulin, body set weight, and obesity. Obesity develops when the hypothalamus orders the body to increase fat mass to reach the desired body set weight. Available calories are diverted to increase fat, leaving the body short of energy, calories. The body's rational response is to try to get more calories. It increases the hormonal signals of hunger and decreases hormonal signals of satiety. We can resist the urge to eat and restrict our calorie consumption. Doing so will thwart the hypothalamus for a while, but it has other means of persuasion. The body conserves calories needed for fat growth by shutting down other functions, and metabolism slows. Increased calories in and decreased calories out, eating more and moving less, does not cause obesity, but is instead the result of obesity. Body set weight is tightly regulated. Most people's weight remains relatively stable. Even people who gain weight tend to do so extremely gradually, 1 to 2 pounds per year. This does not mean, however, that body set weight is unchanging. Over time, there is a gradual upward resetting of the body's weight thermostat. The key to understanding obesity is to understand what regulates body set weight, why body set weight is set so high, and how to reset it lower. As a key regulator of energy storage and energy balance, insulin is an obvious suspect as the body set weight regulator. If insulin causes obesity, it must do so predominantly through its effect in the brain. Obesity is controlled in the central nervous system through the body set weight, not in the periphery. In this hypothesis, high insulin levels increase the body set weight. Certainly, the insulin response differs greatly between lean and obese patients. Obese patients tend to have a higher fasting insulin level as well as an exaggerated insulin response to food. See figure 6.1. It is possible that this hormonal activity leads to weight gain. Does insulin cause obesity? That question, the key to a hormonal theory of obesity, is explored in detail in the next chapter. Chapter 7. Insulin. I can make you fat. Actually, I can make anybody fat. How? By prescribing insulin. It won't matter that you have willpower or that you exercise. It won't matter what you choose to eat. You will get fat. It's simply a matter of enough insulin and enough time. High insulin secretion has long been associated with obesity. Obese people secrete much higher levels of insulin than do those of normal weight. Also, in lean subjects, insulin levels quickly return to baseline after a meal, but in the obese, these levels remain elevated. Insulin levels are almost 20% higher in obese subjects, and these elevated levels are strongly correlated to important indices such as waist circumference and waist-hip ratio. The close association between insulin levels and obesity certainly suggests, but does not prove, the causal nature of this relationship. Insulin levels can be difficult to measure since levels fluctuate widely throughout the day in response to food. It is possible to measure an average level, but doing so requires multiple measurements throughout the day. Fasting insulin levels, measured after an overnight fast, are a simpler one-step measurement. Sure enough, research reveals a close association between high fasting insulin levels and obesity, and this relationship becomes even stronger when we consider only a person's fat mass rather than his or her total weight. In the San Antonio Heart Study, high fasting insulin was tightly correlated to weight gain over 8 years of follow-up. As we shall see in Chapter 10, an insulin-resistant state leads also to a high fasting insulin. This relationship is not coincidental, as insulin resistance itself plays a key role in causing obesity. So, we know that the association between elevated insulin and obesity has already been clearly established. The question now is whether this association is, in fact, a causal relationship. Does high insulin cause obesity? Putting it to the test. The insulin causes obesity hypothesis is easily tested. We can prove a causal relationship by experimentally giving insulin to a group of people and then measuring their weight gain. Therefore, for our experiment, here's our fundamental question. If you take insulin, will you get fat? The short answer is an emphatic yes. Patients who use insulin regularly and physicians who prescribe it already know the awful truth. The more insulin you give, the more obese you get. Insulin causes obesity. Numerous studies, conducted mostly on diabetic patients, have already demonstrated this fact. Insulin causes weight gain. Insulin is commonly used to treat both types of diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, there is destruction of the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas, resulting in very low levels of insulin. Patients require insulin injections to survive. In type 2 diabetes, cells are resistant to insulin and insulin levels are high. Patients do not always require insulin and are often treated first with oral medications. In the landmark 1993 Diabetes Control and Complications trial, researchers compared a standard dose of insulin to a high dose designed to tightly control blood sugars in type 1 diabetic patients. At the end of 6 years, the study proved that intensive control of blood sugars resulted in fewer complications for those patients. However, what happened to their weight? Participants in the high-dose group gained, on average, approximately 9.8 pounds, 4.5 kilograms more than participants in the standard group. Yowzers! More than 30% of patients experienced major weight gain. Prior to the study, both groups were more or less equal in weight, with little obesity. The only difference between the groups was the amount of insulin administered. Were these patients suddenly lacking in willpower? Were they lazier than they had been before the study? Were they more gluttonous? No, no, and no. Insulin levels were increased. Patients gained weight. Long-term studies in type 2 diabetes show the same weight-gaining effect of insulin. The United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study Group, organized in the 1970s, was at that time the largest and longest study ever done for type 2 diabetes. Its primary purpose was to determine